This is Marcos from Barcelona, but he could be anyone, anywhere. What is about to happen to him occurs daily in offices and homes all over the world. The part inside the printer has failed, and the manufacturer sends Marcos to technical support.
El meu tècnic fa un diagnòstic previ, però aquest diagnòstic ja són 15 euros més IVA.
Segurament serà difícil encontrar les peces per a poder reparar-la.
Realment, reparar-la no li surt molt a compte.
Que reparar-la parlem d'uns 110, 120 euros.
Tienes impressores des de 39 euros.
Jo t'aconsellaria que miressis impressores noves.
Així que, sens dubte, jo em compraria una nova,
It's no coincidence that all three shopkeepers suggest buying a new printer. If he agrees, Marcos will become yet another victim of planned obsolescence, the secret mechanism at the heart of our consumer society.
Our role in life seems to be just to consume things with credit, to borrow money to buy things we don't need.
Nous vivons dans une société dominée par une économie de croissance dont la logique est non pas croître pour satisfaire les besoins, mais croître pour croître.
So if the consumer does not purchase, you know, the economy is not going to grow.
Planned obsolescence. The desire on the part of a consumer to own something a little newer, a little sooner than is necessary.
This film will reveal how planned obsolescence has defined our lives ever since the 1920s, when manufacturers started shortening the lives of products to increase consumer demand.
Also hat man sich gedacht, dann beschränken wir einfach die Lebensdauer auf 1000 Stunden.
We will find out how designers and engineers were made to adopt new values and objectives.
Was back to the drawing board and come out with something that was more fragile.
Take time, those things. Take time them. So when you finally paid for them, they're used up.
A new generation of consumers has started challenging manufacturers. Is it possible to imagine a viable economy without planned obsolescence, without its impact on the environment?
Posterity will never forgive us. Posterity will suddenly find out about the throwaway lifestyles of people in the advanced countries.
Welcome to Livermore, California, home of the longest burning light bulb in the world. My name's Lynn Owens, and I am chairman of the Light Bulb Committee. It was in 1972 when we discovered that the light bulb that was hanging in the fire station was a significant light bulb.
The light bulb at the Livermore Fire Station has been burning continuously since 1901. Ironically, the bulb has already outlasted two webcams. In 2001, when the bulb was 100 years old, the people of Livermore threw a big birthday party, American style.
I think we were hoping if we would get 200 people, we'd be happy. And we ended up with 800 or 900 people showing up.
One nation, under God, indivisible,
You think that anybody would sing happy birthday to a light bulb? Well, we didn't think they would, but they did.
The origin of the bulb was, it was produced in a town called Shelby, Ohio, back around 1895, and put together by some very interesting ladies that I have some pictures of, and some gentlemen that invested in the company. The filament was invented by Adolphe Chollet. He invented his filament to last. Why does his filament last? I don't know. It's a secret that he made and that died with him.
Chollet's formula for a long-lasting filament is not the only mystery in the history of the light bulb. A much bigger secret is how the humble light bulb became the first victim of planned obsolescence.
Weihnachten 1924 war ein ganz besonderer Tag. In einem Hinterzimmer in Genf trafen sich einige Herren in Nadelstreifenanzügen, um einem geheimen Plan nachzugehen. Sie gründeten das erste weltweite Kartell, das sich zum Ziel setzte, die Glühbirnenproduktion der gesamten Länder zu kontrollieren und den Kuchen namens Weltmarkt unter sich aufzuteilen. Dieses Kartell hat den Namen Phoebus.
Phoebus included the main light bulb manufacturers in Europe and the United States and even faraway colonies in Asia and Africa.
Das Ziel ist gewesen, Patente auszutauschen, die Produktion zu kontrollieren und vor allem aber den Verbraucher zu kontrollieren. Es ist umso besser für diese Firmen, wenn der Verbraucher regelmäßig Glühlampen kauft. Und wenn die Glühlampen lange brennen, ist das ein ökonomischer Nachteil.
Initially, manufacturers strived for a long lifespan for their bulbs.
Numerous experiments resulted in the production of a small unit lamp of comparatively enormous resistance. The filament being under conditions of great stability after the...
Thomas Edison's first commercial bulb, on sale by 1881, lasted 1,500 hours. By 1924, when the Phoebus cartel was founded, manufacturers proudly advertise lifespans of up to 2,500 hours and stress the longevity of their bulbs.
Also hat man sich bei Phoebus gedacht, dann beschränken wir einfach die Lebensdauer dieser einzelnen Glühbirnen auf 1,000 Stunden. 1925 wird ein entsprechendes Komitee gegründet, das 1,000-Hour-Life-Komitee, was sich zum Ziel setzt, auf technischer Basis die Lebensdauer der Glühlampen auf diese Brenndauer zu beschränken.
More than 80 years later, Helmut Hüge, an historian from Berlin, uncovers proof of the committee's activities hidden in the internal documents of the founding members of the cartel, such as Philips in Holland, Osram in Germany, and Compagnie des Lampes in France.
Hier haben wir ein Kartelldokument, da steht: The average life of lamps for general lighting service must not be guaranteed, published or offered for another value than 1,000 hours.
Under pressure from the cartel, member companies conducted experiments to create a more fragile bulb that would conform with the new 1,000-hour rule. Bulb production was monitored rigorously to make sure cartel members complied.
Eine Maßnahme bestand beispielsweise darin, einen Prüfstand zu errichten, in dem viele kleine Sockel zu finden sind, in die dann wiederum einzelne Exemplare aus verschiedenen Produktionsreihen eingeschraubt wurden. Und Firmen wie Osram haben dann genauestens protokolliert, wie lange diese Lampen brannten.
Phoebus enforced its rules through an elaborate bureaucracy. Members were fined heavily if their monthly life reports were off the mark.
Hier haben wir eine Straftabelle aus dem Jahr 1929, die genau zeigt, wie viel Schweizer Franken Strafe für 1000 verkaufte Glühbirnen die Mitglieder des Kartells zahlen müssen, wenn die Lampen länger halten als zum Beispiel 1500 Stunden.
As planned obsolescence took effect, lifespans fell steadily. In just 2 years, they dropped from 2,500 hours to less than 1,500 hours. By the 1940s, the cartel had reached its goal. 1,000 hours had become the standard lifespan for bulbs.
I can see how this was very tempting in 1932. I think at the time, sustainability was actually substantially less of an issue because I don't think they looked at the planet as being one with finite amount of resources. They looked at it as from an abundance perspective.
Ironically, the light bulb has always been a symbol for ideas and innovation, and yet it's one of the early and best examples of planned obsolescence.
In the following decades, inventors filed dozens of patents for new light bulbs, including one lasting 100,000 hours. None of them reached the general market.
Offiziell hat es ja Phoebus eigentlich nie gegeben, wenn auch diese Spuren der Öffentlichkeit nie ganz verborgen gewesen sind. Die Strategie dahinter ist, sich in bestimmten Zeitabständen immer wieder umzubenennen. Dann heißt es mal internationales Elektrizitätskartell, dann mal wieder irgendein anderer Name. Entscheidend ist, dass diese Idee als Institution natürlich weiter besteht.
In Barcelona, Marcos hasn't followed the advice of the shopkeepers to replace his printer. He's determined to repair it and has found somebody on the internet who has discovered what has actually happened to his printer.
It's the dirty little secret of inkjet printers. I tried to print a document and it said parts inside your printer require replacement, so I decided to do a little servicing of my own.
Hello, Marcos. I got your message.
Marcos has contacted the author of the video.
How are you? I looked into it and it turns out that there's a thing in the bottom of the printer called a waste ink reservoir. And the way inkjet printers work is they constantly have to clean the print heads, and they do that by squirting ink through them down a hole in the bottom of the printer into this great big sponge. There's just a preset time when it's squirted a certain number of drops down there that then the printer decides it's full of ink and won't function anymore. Mm-hmm. The justification is they don't want to put ink all over your desk. But I think the problem goes deeper than that. It's the way the technology works. It's just designed to fail.
Planned obsolescence emerged at the same time as mass production and the consumer society.
The whole issue with products being made to last less long is part of a whole pattern that began in the Industrial Revolution when the new machines were producing goods so much more cheaply, which was a great thing for consumers, but consumers couldn't keep up with the machines. There was so much production.
As early as 1928, an influential advertising magazine warned that an article that refuses to wear out is a tragedy of business. In fact, mass production made many goods widely available. Prices fell and many people started shopping for fun rather than need. The economy was booming. Emerging consumer society came to a full stop when the Wall Street crash sent the U.S. into a deep economic recession.
Unemployment reached staggering proportions. By 1933, one-fourth of our labor force was unemployed.
People no longer queued for goods, but for work and for food. From New York came a radical proposal on how to kickstart the economy again. Bernard London, a prominent real estate broker, suggested ending the Depression by making planned obsolescence compulsory by law. It was the first time the concept was put into writing. Under Bernard London's proposal, all products would be given a lease of life with a set expiry date, after which they would be considered legally dead. Consumers would turn them over to a government agency where they would be destroyed.
He was trying to achieve a balance between capital and labor where there would always be a market for new goods. So there would always be a need for labor and there would always be a reward for capital.
Bernard London believed that with compulsory planned obsolescence, the wheels of industry would keep turning, people would keep consuming, and everyone would have a job. Giles Slade has come to New York to investigate the person behind the idea. He wants to find out if, for Bernard London, planned obsolescence was purely about profits or about helping the unemployed.
I have a picture of Bernard London.
Dorothea Weitzner remembers meeting Bernard London in the 1930s during a family outing.
Don't tell me which one he is.
Okay.
Let's see. Oh, isn't that interesting? Yes. Definitely intellectual looking.
And you met Bernard London in 1933.
When I was about 16, 17, my dad and mother had this big Cadillac car, which was the size of a Zeppelin. Mother was driving like a chauffeur. Dad was in the front, and Mr. and Mrs. London were in the back of the big limousine. Dad said that Mr. London should explain his philosophy to me. He's a very interesting man. And he just told me in a few words that that was his idea to reduce the Depression. We were in an economic mess, worse than today even. He was obsessed with this idea, like an artist is utterly obsessed with his paintings, you know. He actually whispered to me in the car, afraid that his theory might be too radical.
In fact, Bernard London's proposal was ignored. An obsolescence by legal obligation was never put into practice. 20 years later, in the 1950s, the idea resurfaced, but with a crucial twist. Instead of forcing planned obsolescence on the consumers, they were to be seduced by it.
Planned obsolescence, the desire on the part of a consumer to own something a little newer, a little better, a little sooner than is necessary. We certainly in America...
This is the voice of Brooks Stevens, the apostle of planned obsolescence in post-war America. This flamboyant industrial designer created everything from household appliances to cars and trains, always with planned obsolescence in mind. In the spirit of the times, Brooks Stevens' designs conveyed speed and modernity. Even the house he lived in was unusual.
This is the home that my father designed and that I grew up in. When it was being built out in the suburbs, everybody thought it was going to be the new Greyhound bus station because it did not look like a traditional home. One of the most important things that my father felt always in designing a product is that it made a statement. He detested products that were bland and really did not, you know, create any desire within the consumer to inspire the purchase.
Unlike the European approach of the past, where they tried to make the very best product and make it last forever, meaning you bought such a fine suit of clothes that you were married in it and then buried in it, and never a chance to renew it. The approach in America is one of making the American consumer unhappy with the product that he has enjoyed the use of for a period, have him pass it on to the second-hand market, and obtain the newest product with the newest possible look.
Brooks Stevens traveled all over the U.S. to promote planned obsolescence in speech after speech. His approach became the gospel of the time.
Women and men alike are increasingly interested in the look of things.
They eagerly give their attention to what's new and beautiful and advanced.
Design and marketing seduced consumers into always craving the latest model.
My father never designed a product to intentionally fail or become obsolete for some functional reason in a short period of time. Planned obsolescence is absolutely at the consumer's discretion. No one is forcing the consumer to go into the store and purchase a product. They go in under their own free will. That's their choice.
Freedom and happiness through unlimited consumption. The American way of life in the 1950s became the foundation for the consumer society as we know it today.
See, without planned obsolescence, these places wouldn't exist. There wouldn't be any products, there wouldn't be any industry, there wouldn't be any designers, architects, there wouldn't be any salespeople, cleaners, there wouldn't be any security guards. All the jobs would go.
So how often do you change your mobiles?
18 months.
Once a year.
These days, planned obsolescence is an integral part of the curriculum at design and engineering schools. Boris Knuth lectures on the concept of product life cycle, a modern euphemism for planned obsolescence.
I went shopping for you. I've got a couple of things. A pan, salt, shirt, another shirt.
Students are taught how to design for a business world dominated by one single goal, frequent repeat purchase.
What I do, I pass these round, and you tell me what you think, how long it takes for them to fail, what the service life will be.
Okay. Designers have to understand what company they work for. The company decides on a business model, how often do we want to renew our products, our offers. So this brief is given to designers, and designers have to understand and design the product in a certain way so it fits exactly the business strategy of the client they work for.
Planned obsolescence is at the root of the substantial economic growth that the Western world has experienced since the 1950s. Ever since, growth has been the holy grail of our economy.
Nous vivons dans une société de croissance dont la logique est non pas croître pour satisfaire les besoins, mais croître pour croître, croître à l'infini, faire croître sans limite la production et pour justifier cette croissance de la production, faire croître sans limite la consommation.
Serge Latouche is a noted critic of the growth society and has written extensively about its mechanisms.
Au fond, il y a trois instruments fondamentaux qui sont la publicité, l'obsolescence programmée et le crédit.
In the last generation or so, our role in life seems to be just to consume things with credit, to borrow money to buy things we don't need. That makes no real sense to me at all.
Critics of the growth society point out that it's unsustainable in the long run because it's based on a flagrant contradiction.
Celui qui croit qu'une croissance infinie est compatible avec une planète finie est soit un fou, soit un économiste. Le drame, c'est qu'au fond, nous sommes tous des économistes maintenant.
Why is it that a new product is created every 3 minutes somewhere in the world? Is this necessary? I think a lot of people have realized that things need to change when they're being told by politicians to go shopping or to start consuming as the best way to restart the economy.
On peut dire qu'avec la société de croissance, on est embarqué dans un bolide qui désormais manifestement n'a plus de pilote, qui va à toute allure et dont on peut prévoir le destin, qui est soit de se fracasser contre un mur, soit de sombrer dans un précipice.
Looking at the service manuals of different printers, Marcos realizes that the lifespan of many printers is set by the engineers right from the start. They achieve this by placing a chip deep inside the printer.
Chip que es una EEPROM, que es un chip donde es guarda una cuenta de impresiones, y cuando se arriba a una determinada cuenta es cuando desbloquea la impresora y deja de imprimir.
How do engineers feel about designing products to fail? The dilemma is captured in a British film from 1951, where a young chemist invents an everlasting thread. He believes that great progress has been made.
There he is.
But not everyone is happy with his discovery, and soon he finds himself on the run, not only from the factory owners, but also from the workers, all fearing for their jobs.
Well, that's really interesting, and it reminds me of something that actually happened in the textile industry.
In 1940, the chemical giant DuPont announced the arrival of a revolutionary synthetic fiber, nylon. Girls celebrated the new long-lasting